Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea oko eko ka aha, inahe kuliana imu okea aha ho kolokolo ki ike hanohano okamoko aina o Hawaii. Inau mai, e malio mai, ilohi I kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Inoho ilalo, please be seated.
Morning, please call the case.
Case number SCWC-23-0000701. Marcus L. Kawatachi, in his official capacity as Executive Director of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission, ex-relation Robert A. Fawn and Brenda A. Fawn, respondent plaintiff appellant, versus the Parish Collection LLC, the Parish Collection Kauai, Jonathan D. Parrish and Simone McCaffrey, petitioners, defendants, appellees, and Linda Evans as trustee of the Laura P. Evans Revocable Trust, dated May 8, 2002, defendant appellee. Arguing for petitioners, the Parish Collection et al., Mark Valencia, also appearing is Alana Johnson. Arguing for respondent, Marcus L. Kawatachi, Eric Pili La'au. Argument on the merits.
Morning to you all. Today's proceeding or argument is going to be broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel and also Lelo. The court also wants to welcome and thank Second Circuit Judge, our Substitute Justice, Judge Dewar. Thank you for being here today and serving on this case. Counsel, each side has 30 minutes. I understand, Mr. Valencia, you're going to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. All right. Mr. Pili La'au, the yellow warning light will let you know that there's 10 minutes left in your time. Mr. Valencia.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, Associate Justices, thank you for agreeing to take this case. Seems like Alana and I were just here. Saw you last month. Good to see you again. Thank you for agreeing to address these important issues. I served as a commissioner on the Civil Rights Commission for 6 years. It's a terrific agency. They have a great mission. They do terrific work. They do a wonderful job protecting the rights of the people of Hawaii. Respectfully, in this case, they got it wrong. And there are two issues that we presented in our application. The first is the interactive issue. That's more of a purely legal issue. And the second is the reasonable accommodation issue under 515. And I'll address both and subject to your questions in that order. On the interactive issue, this really comes down to a separation of powers question. And there is very clearly no language in 515 that requires an interactive process. And what we have here is the commission, who apparently over the course of the past couple decades have been imposing legal liability for the failure to engage in the interactive process as a standalone claim. They don't have the statutory authority to do that. It's not in their administrative rules. And we've cited you a Ninth Circuit decision that's one of many from the circuit courts where they had the same issue. It's directly on point. It's a roadmap. Both sides have cited the same case. And they evaluated the Fair Housing Act, and the exact same issue came up. Does the Fair Housing Act, the Federal Fair Housing Act, have a requirement in the statute to engage in the interactive process? The answer was no. And the Ninth Circuit did his job and said, hey, the Congress has spoken. They have not included this requirement. And we think that's a roadmap for this court.
What about HRS 515-3A-4, where it says it is a discriminatory practice to refuse to negotiate for a real estate transaction? And then real estate transaction under 515-2 is defined to include the lease of real property, but the commission's rules 12 46302 further define real estate transaction as including but not limited to actions related to real property after the lease. Also, real estate transaction includes cancellation or termination of a lease. It also includes the imposition of policies and practices affecting the terms of using the real property. I understand interactive process, the language is not there, but why wouldn't there be liability for refusal to negotiate?
You're talking about a different section, and I think each one of those subsections under 515.3 apply to different areas. So the issue that we're falling under is subsection 9, which is...
But you raise the issue of whether or not there's a duty to engage in an interactive process. It is our duty to research the law and determine what law applies. You say A9... But A4 talks about refusal to negotiate.
Correct. So the refusal to negotiate, I think, is separate and apart from the duty to provide a reasonable accommodation for a disability. It's just different. And that's why there are different paragraphs here that apply to different transactions, different issues.
But Fawn was trying to negotiate modification of that term on these weekly cleanings.
Correct.
And they weren't denying it altogether. They just said they wanted it limited to 1 hour. They're willing to work out the time. So why isn't that negotiation? Why doesn't it fall under subsection A1 or 4?
Chief Justice, they were not negotiating. What they did was they gave us an ultimatum. And you have a lot of argument from the commission that we took a take it or leave it approach. That's not the case. They presented us.
Well, they said, how about allowing periodic inspections?
Correct, Justice. They said no cleaning, but periodic inspections. But they said, take it or leave it. We're not allowing you in to clean.
Well, you folks said take it or leave it. It says no exceptions. It's in the lease.
So
that was a position that was conveyed to them.
Actually, Chief Justice, what we did was respond to their request, which turned out to be a demand through their San Diego lawyer, which was don't enforce the weekly cleaning provision. So that was a demand on their part. There was never any wiggle room in that demand. They never came
off. That position was expressed in October. That was well before the letter came from the San Diego attorney.
Correct. So that was their position from the beginning.
Yeah, but I'm correcting you. It was not in response to the San Diego attorney. That came well before.
Yeah, you're correct. I should be more precise with my language. The initial request from them was that we not enforce the weekly cleaning provision. That request never wavered. It turned into a demand when we got the letter from their lawyer.
And you took the position that it was in the lease, so it was non-negotiable, and that they didn't say anything when they signed the lease. But they made it clear that the reason they asked for this is because the state of Hawaii had changed its policy to allow people to come in with a COVID test. And before, we did have a strict 14-day quarantine, but that was now going to be waived. And that's when they asked they were concerned that people would be coming in, tourists would be coming in, maybe they had a negative, but then we know that it takes a few days and your cleaning people might be going in and cleaning and being exposed to people that had a negative before they came in, but may have had COVID, right? And so that's when they asked for this. And so isn't requesting that this be changed tantamount to requesting an amendment of the lease?
I don't think they were asking for an amendment. They were asking for it not to be enforced. So
right. They're asking that provision be eliminated, right?
Yes.
Or a different accommodation be made, like periodic inspections.
Right. And what their request falls under, I'm kind of getting ahead to their reasonableness analysis, but it falls under the reasonableness analysis. And there's two elements that we are challenging there. One is whether their request is reasonable, and second is whether we provided a reasonable accommodation to them. Offer. And under the reasonableness analysis, your facts are correct that they did make the request after the quarantine was lifted. Their request was not reasonable because it was selective. So I think if they would have taken the position that the quarantine's lifted and we don't want to allow anyone into our home because we're afraid that Mr. Fan might contract COVID, that's not what happened. They allowed.
But they took the position, they explained that the reason that they were allowing repair people in is because it dealt with, like, the AC broke down or the dishwasher broke down. You know, these are issues that go to habitability, safety, you know, whether you can actually live in this place. Whereas cleaning is perhaps not something that's absolutely necessary and something that they could do themselves. That's how they explained it, right? That they couldn't fix the AC, they couldn't fix the dishwasher. That's why they would have to allow others to come in. But cleaning is something they were taking the position they could do themselves.
That's how they explained it. Their explanation was not reasonable.
So why isn't this a question of fact? How did the ICA get it wrong by saying this wasn't a question of fact?
So in two aspects. First, on the reasonableness aspect, which whether or not their request was reasonable, and just to address the issues you brought up, this didn't deal with habitability. The only issue that is arguably habitability is when they complained late in the game in December that there was a gas leak. Turned out there wasn't a gas leak. The gas container was empty. But the other two items... AC?
No AC?
So anyone, as we all have lived in Hawaii for a very long time, knows AC is a perk. And out before, you
well,
know...
I don't know how this place is configured, but depending on the airflow, AC is not necessarily a perk sometimes.
Well, we know, Justice McKenna, from living here that, you know, before the development of the leeward side, most houses didn't have AC in Hawaii, you know, and so it was...
Okay, but all of that is subject to inferences, and all inferences have to be made in favor of the non-moving party. You're just kind of going back and forth on what you believe is reasonable and what the court saw as a genuine issue of material fact. And, you know, I want to go back to these, in what you call inspections. They weren't really inspections that they agreed to. They actually agreed to cleaning. It was just limited in time to an hour. So they weren't blocking all cleaning altogether. Isn't that what the record reflects, at least in Ms. Fawn's email of September 30th? She says, I'm fine with allowing the weekly cleanings, but just for an hour. How do you respond to that?
That is not what they were requesting. They requested no enforcement of the cleaning provision.
I am fine to have cleaners weekly for an hour and to find a time. That's her exact words in this email that was part of the summary judgment exhibits. I'm reading from it.
Yes. And so their subsequent letter from their attorney said no cleanings, that they would not allow us. And the letter that we provided from...
Yeah, but if I'm going back to the point that Justice McKenna is raising, shouldn't that have been negotiated? Isn't that part of 515.3, both A1 and 4? The obligation to negotiate this part of the agreement.
I think it depends. If you are going to take the position
that... Depends on what?
If you're going to take the position that the interactive process, because that's what it sounds like you're saying, that the interactive process is a requirement, then I don't agree with that, because that goes back to the initial threshold question.
I'm asking if those subsections imply an interactive process. That's the question.
I don't think they do. And if you're just using the basic rules of statutory construction, the plain meaning rule, the language is not there.
It says refuse to negotiate for a real estate transaction. And I read you the definition
right.
of real estate transaction, which includes actions after the lease. You seem to be taking the position that once there's a provision like this at the time of the original lease, if a person later discovers, learns, or later develops a disability, game over, no negotiation, despite A4.
Not at all. I think it's two different issues. So whether or not there is standalone liability for the failure to engage in the interactive process, one issue. Whether or not there's an obligation to offer a reasonable accommodation, different issue. So I think
Let me ask you this. Don't you think it's wrapped up in one? Let's say we agreed with you that there's no standalone liability. Don't you think the failure would go towards your refusal to make a reasonable accommodation? Isn't it part of that? Wouldn't that be considered?
You know, and looking at this issue as I was preparing, it is kind of difficult to separate the interactive process, even if it's not expressly in the statute, from the duty to provide a reasonable accommodation, because you do have to have a discussion, right? And there was a discussion. So, no, I don't think that there is a requirement there to engage in that process. Our only requirement, based on the plain language of the statute, is to offer a reasonable accommodation.
I understand that position, but doesn't it sort of go towards the issue of reasonable accommodation if you're going to just say take it or leave it? And by the way, with part of those emails and where the evidence says it's, you know, that's bull reasons, and I might disagree with your take it or leave it position, but irrespective, even aside from the lack of interactive process in the law or in the regs, it seems that the refusal to at least talk does relate to the reasonable accommodation issue, doesn't it?
It does if we are not providing an actual reasonable accommodation. But if, and there I will agree that, you know, some of the background discussions between JP and Simone were a bit harsh. But the fact is we offered to clean the place when they were not there based on their schedule. That was a reasonable accommodation. What they were offering was not a reasonable accommodation. And
it sounds to me that there would be questions of fact as to what is a reasonable accommodation under these circumstances. And you seem to be arguing that only the accommodation you offered was the only reasonable one. Why couldn't reasonable minds differ as to what a reasonable accommodation would be under these circumstances?
Well, Justice McKenna, this is one of those cases where the facts are not in dispute. So just to first address the issue of whether it goes back, we don't have a dispute over what was offered by each side. We don't have credibility issues like who's telling the truth. So really, it just is applying the law to those undisputed facts. That's what summary judgment's for.
Well, I noticed that in your motion, you initially took the position that there was no disability, right?
Absolutely. I still have that position. We didn't argue that here. But because if you look at so Justice McKenna, if you look at the request that Mr. Fahn made, the letter from his doctor, none of them identify what the disability is. And so even the Fifth Circuit was having trouble trying to figure out, well, what exactly is the disability? And at best, we can determine it was the fear of catching COVID, which includes everybody.
You mentioned the attorney's letter, the attorney from San Diego, but he set it forth. He said it's heart disease and hypertension, which gives Mr. Fahn a higher risk of COVID infection and serious illness. So he spelled it out, or she, I'm sorry.
She did in that letter, yes. So what I was saying is initially when they first requested the accommodation, there was no identification of the actual disability.
Before you folks filed the summary possession, the attorney informed you exactly what the underlying health condition was. So
right.
Your client knew.
So regarding, though, that letter, when you're looking at whether or not a reasonable accommodation was offered by their side, and this has to be considered part of their reasonable accommodation request, this letter that you're referring to, she asked for $5,000 in attorney's fees, $10,000 in damages, a 50% reduction in the rent of $6,000 a month. That's not reasonable.
What was unreasonable about limiting it to one hour a week? That was the original position that you rejected, your client rejected. What was unreasonable about that?
Because it places limits on whether or not the place can actually be cleaned. And I think that's a significant issue.
In other words, it's like, I'm assuming you're using a cleaning service. You know, some cleaning services, they bring one person. You know, if you, Why couldn't it be a reasonable accommodation to have three people or four people come in and do all the cleaning within 1 hour?
I don't think that that
restriction... Because it's $40 an hour, right?
I don't think that restriction was reasonable because it would depend on how dirty the place was. And as we saw, which is undisputed, when they moved out, the place had to be cleaned and repaired to the tune
of... Okay, but at the time, there was no dispute as to whether or not an hour was adequate or not. I didn't see anything in the record in the summary judgment attachments that said 1 hour was inadequate. That wasn't challenged.
Yeah, well, it was because we told them that we have to come in and clean, and we weren't bound by a time restriction in the lease.
I know you're not bound. Right. I know what the term was, and you're right on that. But I'm just saying there was no pushback on whether or not an hour was adequate or not, and that was the offer from the missus.
Right. And so, but in response to that, CJ, how is asking them to allow us to clean when they're not in the property reasonable? I don't know.
But that goes on to, you know, issues of material fact is.
Well, that's what I wanted to talk about, because just one issue that I think definitely does not get sent back, that I don't think they can overcome, is on the fourth element of this test, whether or not what we offered was reasonable. The only way that it's reasonable is if their request does not require a fundamental alteration of our program. And what they were asking us to do was not come in and clean. I understand the first email you're talking about, but that was not their position. I mean, you have their attorney's letter. That's not their position. Their position was don't come in. So
because you folks were responding, take it or leave it. So now they're escalating. Well, that's what I see the record reflecting.
The take it or leave it was, we will work around your schedule to clean when you are not there. That was reasonable. What they were saying is, don't enforce that provision. That's an alteration of the program. That's not a fact dispute.
September 30th, Mrs. Fawn says, that's fine. Let's limit it to an hour. And I didn't see any real response to that.
Yeah, the response was, we have to come in and clean for basically however long it takes us to get the place clean. And
I really saw that in the record, in the summary judgment.
So there's a letter from Ms. McCaffrey that says, you have selectively only allowed us or vendors to enter the property to make any repairs that are affecting your enjoyment of the property. You do not allow us to also inspect the property at the time as all the doors are closed. We have tried several times.
What's the date of that email that you're reading from?
I'm sorry?
What's the date of that?
November 16th. So this is in response. So we have tried several times via email and phone to set up a mutually agreeable time to schedule the required cleaning after your completed quarantine. However, you have refused to allow us access to the home verbally and in writing.
So that's 2 months after Ms. Fawn first said an hour.
This is the response. And
2 months later.
Well, this was
November.
Yeah, what she's saying is, we have tried several times to set up calls and emails with you, and you haven't responded. So this wasn't the first time they were responding.
Right, there was other back and forth as well.
There's back and forth.
Skipped over.
Right? That's correct. Yes, but on that issue of the fourth element, how do they get around that? What they were asking for, see, my light is on. They were asking for a fundamental alteration of the program. And if you apply the case law, that is not considered reasonable. And also, there can't be an undue burden on us. And we had that. We had $5,500-plus worth of damage and cleaning that we had to do, which not only is an undue...
Well, that's also an issue of material fact. They deny that happened. So that's your perspective and your position, but they deny that was the condition of the...
No, actually, CJ, it's not disputed. So we took their deposit. We gave them an inventory, and they didn't challenge it. There's a very simple process.
They might not have challenged it, you know, but when you look at it, when I reviewed, like, the receipts and stuff, these cleaning fees, it's a little bit, wow, isn't there, like, $1,400 for cleaning, bedspreads and things of that nature? It seemed a little bit high to me. I don't know. I guess this is taking it to a – it was estimates of taking it to a dry cleaner or something. to clean everything?
Justice McGinn, it was all outlined in the very comprehensive list that they gave them with receipts. And they were asked during the hearing.
It wasn't just cleaning, because you charged, apparently, they said nightstands were missing, so you charged for that, right?
Correct.
And they said there were other things, maybe a few things from the kitchen that were missing, so you charged for that. It wasn't just cleaning fees.
It was damage.
Or things that are missing.
Correct.
Right? But why wouldn't it be a reasonable accommodation to say then that, you know, because even then you did return some money out of the $6,000 deposit. Why not request an additional deposit? Like, we don't know how much the cleaning is going to be. So why don't you make an additional deposit so that we can have a professional, thorough professional cleaning at the time you leave? Why wouldn't that be a reasonable accommodation?
Arguably, it could have been, but we're not required to offer multiple accommodations. We're required to offer a reasonable accommodation. And so
what you say goes.
Well, not necessarily.
The landlord gets to dictate what's reasonable.
The landlord gets to provide an accommodation. Whether or not that's reasonable is up for you to decide. We think it was reasonable. That's your call. And regarding that security deposit, this is the colloquy between the court during the hearing. The court. And so I saw the exhibit that Mr. Valencia talked about. Was there anything done to dispute that, talking about the money that we took? Mr. Pililao, no. They just took, I think it was like 95% of the security deposit. The court, right. I mean, but you can dispute that. Mr. Pililao, yeah. The court, was there any dispute on that cleaning post-leaving? Mr. Pililao, I don't believe so,
Does
Judge.
The circuit court have jurisdiction over residential security deposits?
Small claims.
Isn't it exclusive jurisdiction of district court?
It's small claims. But what the court was asking was, did your clients dispute that $5,500 plus? And they said no, they didn't.
Well, they did dispute. Yeah, but they did dispute it in the opposition to the summary judgment. It was in the declaration of at least Mr. Fawn, where he says, although not professionally clean, we left the house in the same or better condition then we found it when we moved in. So there was a genuine issue of material fact on that issue, wasn't there?
No, that's a disputed fact. Is it genuine? Is it material? No, it's not, because you don't need that fact to make your decision.
You know, I noticed that the explanation of the cleanliness at the time of the cleaning, I noticed something about 46 photos, and I kind of looked for them, but I didn't see them. Did you attach the photos to the MSJ? Because I was thinking, oh, I would like to see these photos as to the condition of the premises at the time it was cleaned.
I don't recall off the top of my head. I'll have to check and look at our declaration to see what the declaration authenticated. I'm not sure, Justice McKenna, if we did or not. But the issue isn't, you know, a jurisdictional question about who has jurisdiction over the deposit. It's whether or not that weekly cleaning provision was necessary. And, you know, going back to the issue that I think there's no answer for, is it was an alteration of the program. What they were asking for was a fundamental alteration of the program. And if that's the case...
What if we disagree with you on that?
Well, then I lose. So then it goes back. But I think you really don't need to send this back, because we're not fighting about what happened. So whether or not the place was pristine or not, we're not fighting about that. Whether or not... there was an alteration of the program, that's a legal question for you to decide. And honestly, the ICA's opinion didn't address it. All they said was, we didn't provide evidence to negate an element of proof, and broadly reference the exhibits. But that's just not correct.
Well, the ICA was trying to apply the Ralston standard.
Yes.
Do you dispute that Ralston applies here?
I don't dispute it.
So summary judgment was granted 3 months after this action was initiated. I mean, there was no discovery or limited discovery. Certainly the discovery deadline hadn't expired by then, right? So under Ralston, one of the things I think you were trying to do was to demonstrate that the commission would not be able to carry its burden of proof at trial. That's a tall order 3 months after the case is initiated.
It absolutely is, and I'm a glutton for punishment. I file these motions all the time, and they're usually denied. But the those issues, those cases typically involve some genuine issues of material fact. You don't have that here.
One of the things I heard you arguing was, well, you know, the disability, all we have really is the letter from the doctor. I mean, there could have been much more developed and presented at trial as to what that disability was and as to why they were so concerned about having folks in the house. That's something that could have been developed, right? I mean, and so what I'm hearing is this, all of these factors in terms of what's reasonable kind of depends on some of that. Why doesn't it?
I don't think it does, because even though this was early, I mean, the rules are in place for a reason. If we are allowed to put in evidence that says, hey, here are the facts, they have to come back and tell us one of two things. There are genuine issues of material fact, or we're wrong on the law. So if regarding the facts, we don't have a dispute.
Or they need more time for discovery.
And there was no 56F requirement. Correct, CJ, but there was no 56F request here. So they have to come back and tell us there's a dispute on the facts. They didn't do that because the facts were not disputed. They have to come back and tell us we're wrong in the law. And that's where we're arguing. That's why we're here, I think, is because we're arguing about the law, not the facts. The facts aren't disputed. And so even though it's early, and yes, there could have been discovery, they didn't ask for that. They didn't say, hey, look, we need time to develop the record.
Well, they don't need to. You, as the move-on, summary judgment move-on, you have the burden.
We have the burden, right. But 56F is typically, it's for the responding party. So they didn't make that request. So I don't think that they're
really... How did you even meet your burden of establishing that that there would be no way that they could prove their case?
Because the elements of proof for which evidence was submitted wasn't going to change. The declarations that our client put forward, the declarations that the Fonz both signed, those are the core facts. Facts are not going to change.
The circuit court even found that there was no disability here, right?
Honestly, I agree with him based on the record that we didn't know exactly. Having a heart condition, I think, would qualify. Being afraid of catching COVID.
It's not being afraid of catching COVID. It's, well, the risk of what happens after catching COVID. The doctor talked about a 5-6%, just this cardiologist, mortality rate.
Yes.
That's what they were afraid of. And when we look at what is a reasonable accommodation, we look at it from the time frame of what was happening then, right? We're not doing a look back on what we now know. When you think about what was happening then and what people were afraid of, this is before vaccinations. People were dying all over the place.
I agree.
They came here because Hawaii was one of the safest states, and we had a quarantine. That's why they came here. And then we changed it. And that's when they asked to negotiate to get rid of this provision.
They didn't.
Why wouldn't it be a reasonable question of genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not that in and of itself was a reasonable request?
Because
get rid of this.
You have to determine whether or not their request was reasonable. And their request, as summarized in their, I understand that the initial request they made was one thing that morphed. Okay, so the what they were asking for was not reasonable, and the facts regarding what they were asking for are not in dispute. And you have to look at the fact that I think they would have a much stronger case if they said, you know what, we're afraid of him catching COVID, we're not allowing anybody in the place. But that's not what they did. And a dishwasher. I mean, that's not a habitability issue. That's a
It was leaking. I mean, that could cause further damage and make it uninhabitable. It's not just a dishwasher, but it was a leak from what I read from the record.
Well,
that's different.
They wanted it to work. They wanted the dishwasher to work.
Counsel, I do have a question.
Yes.
Following up on Justice McKenna's question, you know, I remember back when COVID was happening, and, you know, to have anyone in your home, people were terrified that you could catch COVID from surfaces, from very different places, and it was before the vaccine. So I'm not sure a reasonable accommodation with a heart condition that could lead to possible death if he contracted COVID would be to allow people they don't know and people that as far as I read, there was some dispute about whether they were using the proper standards and using the protective gear that they were supposed to use when they went in and did the cleaning. So how is that a reasonable accommodation for a person in a condition with a heart problem whose mortality rate is probably 5%, and to continue allowing people to come in that they did not know and they felt might not be following the protective procedures. Explain that to me.
So the state of Hawaii set up protocols. The Fons knew about those protocols when they came to Kauai. That's part of the reason they came here. Our people were following those protocols. I know what you're talking about, where there's a line in the Fons declaration where they said they saw some of the workers not wearing gloves or a mask when they were at someone else's house. That doesn't change the facts. So we say obviously that our people were wearing PPE. We were following the guidelines that the state established. And if they wanted to ensure that people were wearing masks and gloves when they came into their home, all they had to do was say that. But this, I don't think they cannot selectively say, we don't want your guys in at all, but we're going to allow these folks in, one after the other, for these things that are not.
You know, when the cleaners come, as Judge Drewer has said, they clean everything. They touch all surfaces. You know, when you look back on what people were doing then, right? I mean, it's one thing to sterilize just the kitchen area that a dishwasher, the plumber might be fixing, as compared to trying to sterilize everything, every single surface of the house that a housekeeper might have touched. Because we didn't know how things were working at the time. We didn't know how easily or how difficult it was for this disease to spread. This is before all the studies showing, you know, how it actually spread.
I agree. There was a lot we didn't know. Well, I was terrified. I mean, no, this was new.
Everyone was terrified.
Everyone was. So then you don't let anyone in. That's not what they did. And there's undisputed declaration from Mr. Parrish that said he...
So you don't let anyone in. So it's like, it's either you don't let anyone in or you let everybody in. You know, I mean...
You're saying
that it's completely unreasonable to let somebody in but not others.
I'm saying their position is unreasonable. So this isn't my request. So if they are concerned,
what if they were letting their friends or family in? Would you be saying the same thing?
I would if they're taking the position that we don't want him around third parties because we're afraid of exposure and this quarantine has been lifted. If you're being reasonable, then you're not letting anyone in. If I'm afraid of dying, if it's me, I'm not letting anyone in the house. And there's undisputed declaration from Mr. Parrish where he said he personally observed Mr. Fon walking out in the community, no mask, talking to construction workers. That's undisputed.
Yeah, there's some small details in that declaration as to distances and context. I mean, that was just statements that were given. There was no real details on that from what I read.
Well CJ, I guess, so if we're just being reasonable, he could have been shouting from a distance at them, but I don't think that was the case. If he's talking to someone...
Well, just being outside, you know, doesn't cut either way. I mean, that's subject to interpretation and inferences given to the non-moving party and so on.
Not just outside, but outside interacting with people without PPE.
So yeah, but I'm not even sure what that means. Interacting.
No mask.
What does interacting mean?
Talking to
what distance? Who was around? Where was it? Closed facility?
I couldn't.
Outside? Was air blank? I mean, nobody knows, right?
Yeah.
Those are just blanket statements.
They are subject
to inferences.
Well, the inference is, if we're looking at whether or not his request is reasonable, that he wanted to limit his interaction with third parties, that directly contradicts his contention that he needs to limit his interaction with other people. That's not what he was doing.
They may view these services as imperative, air conditioning for the unit in Kauai. They may view it as imperative. We need that to live here. Leaking dishwasher may destroy the entire premises. So they're subject to inferences.
I think that's a concern.
It's just summary judgment.
I think that's a concern for a homeowner, not for someone who's renting like them.
Well, that's your view.
Well, I just think that's so it's not just my view, because the renter isn't responsible for making the repairs. So as a homeowner, if I have a leak, I'm all over it.
But if the homeowner or the renter knows of the leak and does not report it, I'm sure your clients would have collected for the excessive damage for not reporting.
Depends on where the leak came from. If it was caused by the renters, yes. If it was not caused by the renters, I don't think so.
Really? If they just allowed the dishwasher to leak all over the beautiful hardwood floors, never said anything, you wouldn't find that, you wouldn't find liability in that.
We might. Right. I think under that scenario, yes.
I have another question too. During the COVID, at this period in time, pandemic, did your clients make other accommodations regarding cleaning for other renters that made similar requests?
No one else made this request. And that's another part of the actual legal analysis, is whether or not we discriminated against them versus others. This was a standard provision that was in every lease. And we would have honestly made the same kind of arrangement with other people to clean the place when they're not there. These people were not housebound. They were not staying in the house. There was no reason why they couldn't have agreed to let us clean when they were not there.
Well, I'll ask a follow-up on that, actually. Did what evidence supports your client's assertion that mandatory weekly cleaning is an industry standard practice for short-term luxury rentals? I mean, where does that come from?
That comes from my client. I've only represented him for, I think, about 18 years now. He's a broker, works in the industry. He's been managing this business for at least 18 years since I've been representing him, I think longer. That's where it comes from his knowledge. And that's not in dispute. So I think if there was a contention by the commission that was not correct, they should have put in evidence in response to that. That's how summary judgment works. They didn't do that.
Counsel, you're over your time, but we'll give you some time.
Thank you, CJ.
So, Pili Law.
Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court, good morning. My name is Eric Pili Lau, and I represent the respondent plaintiff in this matter, Marcus Kawatachi, Executive Director of the Hawaii Civil Rights Commission. And thank you, Your Honors, for this opportunity. Now, before I go any further, Your Honors, I wanted to disclose something to this court. And I want to disclose that sometimes I have trouble or I have difficulties getting the words out of my mouth. And the reason I want to disclose that to you is because sometimes the look on my face or the sound of my voice, I just want to assure you that I'm not having a medical emergency. So don't call 911, okay? Now, that's all I'm going to say about that. Now, again, Your Honor, thank you for this opportunity. And as you know, defendants point towards two grave errors that they argue that the ICA made in its decision to send this matter back to the circuit court. Defendants has also asked this court to make a decision on whether or not 51539 requires housing providers to engage in good faith when a disabled tenant makes a requested accommodation. And Your Honors, if I may, I'm going to start off with those two grave errors first. And the first one that I'm going to start off with is the ICA's finding that defendants failed to produce documentation negating the reasonableness element of the director's 51539 claim. And to be certain, Your Honors, that finding by the ICA was the right finding, because despite documentation provided by defendants, there still remains genuine issues of material fact as to this element, this reasonableness element. And this is why. We all know what the test is, Your Honors. The test is the accommodation is reasonable unless it would impose an undue burden on the housing provider. And the case law calls says to do a balancing test, right? And so let's balance the benefit of the accommodation to the disabled tenant against the cost or the burden of that same accommodation on the housing provider. And let's just see how that weighs out and what that looks like. And Your Honors, based on an objective view of the circuit court record in this matter, as limited as it may be at this point, the benefit of Robert and Brenda Fahn's requested accommodation to Robert Fahn specifically substantially outweighs any type of cost or burden to the defendants. And this is why. Let's talk about that burden on the defendants. And that's their argument, right, is that they argue that the Fahn's requested accommodation would have caused them undue burden. And they base that entire argument on their claim that the Fahn's left the property damaged, trashed, and filthy. But Your Honors, as you know, based on the record, that is a highly, highly disputed material fact. And so that issue, it should go to a jury to decide. But I'll say this, Your Honors, even if what defendants claim was true, which it isn't, but even if it was true that the Fahn's left the property damaged, trashed, and filthy, shortly after the Fahn's vacated the property and presumably after defendants discovered these damages and needed repairs, defendants kept about 90% of the Fahn's $6,000 security deposit, and they actually gave some of that back to the Fahn's. And so what that should tell you is that the Fahn's $6,000 security deposit was more than enough to cover any of these damages or needed repairs. And so what was the cost or the burden to defendants? It was little to nothing, Your Honors. And so let's weigh that up against the benefit of the accommodation to Robert Fahn. And so what was going to be the benefit of waiving or at least modifying this lease term, this weekly house cleaning lease term I've been calling it? Well, simply, Your Honors, it would have decreased Robert Fahn's risk and chances of catching the COVID-19 virus, which due to his heart disease, right, not due to any fears of catching COVID, due to his heart disease, placed Robert at higher risk for serious illness or death if he were to catch that virus. And Your Honors, as you know, this entire situation went down in the fall of 2020, right in the middle of this raging COVID-19 pandemic. Before there were any vaccines available and concerns and questions about the virus were at its height, particularly about the transmittal of the virus. And so, yes, Your Honors, the benefit of minimizing Robert Fahn's chances and risk of catching this virus, a virus for which he was high risk for serious illness or death if he were to catch that virus, in the middle of a raging pandemic for that virus, substantially outweighs any type of cost to the defendants. And even more, Your Honors, the Fahns were willing to engage in good faith. They were willing to accept a modified version of this lease term. And they even offered, they said, hey, how about periodic inspections of the property? Which you would only think would alleviate any concerns that the defendants had.
What was the response to Brenda Fahn's September 30th email where she offers weekly cleaning, but she says, can we do it within an hour? That's basically what her offer was. Yeah. What was the response to that?
No exceptions. It's in the lease. That's it.
Okay. How would that have changed the fundamental? How would that fundamentally alter the landlord or owner's policy?
Well, Chief Justice, that's their argument, right, is that it would have fundamentally altered their business. And they say that their business is for luxury rental properties, right? But Your Honors, this wasn't the Moana Lua on Kalakaua. And high end, that is very disputed. But again, our main argument is that the Fahns were willing to engage and negotiate.
But my question is, how would that fundamentally alter their cleaning policy if they're still saying you can do it weekly, but let's try it for just an hour? How does that fundamentally alter their existing
policy? It wouldn't have, Your Honor. It wouldn't have. And that was the fund's initial accommodation request. And again, what was the response to that initial accommodation request? It was, best you check out her bull reasons. And we all know what follows after bull. All right, just speculating and take it or leave it. And
you know, with you're making this claim regarding failure, whether there should be standalone liability for failure to engage in an interactive process. And in doing so, you cite to HRS 515.3A9. Now, first of all, 515.3A9 has been substantially amended since the version that was in effect at the time of this lease, correct? Because it was substantially amended in 2022. And 515.3A9 actually in 2020 said it's to refuse to make reasonable accommodations in rules, policies, practices, or services when the accommodations may be necessary to afford a person with a disability equal opportunity to use and enjoy a housing accommodation, right?
Yes,
so
sir.
Where in that statute does it, it seems to me, you heard my questions of to opposing counsel of 515.3A4, which talks about refuse to negotiate for a real estate transaction. And then your rules include what's in A9, amending rules, policies, practices, or services as a part of the definition of real estate transaction. So, but 515.3A9 says it's the refusal to make reasonable accommodations that leads to liability. And you seem to be taking the position that the refusal to negotiate, are you taking the position that a refusal to negotiate leads to standalone liability? And if so, isn't that actually covered under A4?
No, Your Honor, that's not our claim. Our claim is that it's under 515.39 for a denial of a reasonable accommodation. And it's our position that as part of that denial, that defendants failed to engage in interactive process in good faith.
So reasonable accommodations in rules, policies, practices, or services, you're saying is a requirement to engage in an interactive process?
And that's our position.
Do you have a rule? Is there an administrative rule that says, that talks about interactive processes?
Not for 515.
And it exists in which provisions?
They would cover our state's fair employment laws under 378.
Right. But 515.3 and your rules on housing do not include the interactive process requirement. Is that right?
They don't spell it out specifically, Your Honor.
Okay.
You know, picking up on that, you know, if you look at the administrative rules for employment law, 1246.187B, it actually spells it out that an interactive process is required. But that language is missing from the housing.
Yes, Chief
rules.
Justice.
Yeah. Yes. What do you read into that? That maybe it was purposely omitted?
Well, unfortunately, many of our laws are not written how we would like them to be.
Don't you control the rules? You could draft the rules, right?
Yeah, I believe we can. Yeah.
Well, those are the agency's rules, right?
Yes. Yes.
So it's not in the housing provisions.
No, it's not. It's not. But the director's position is follows the finding in the Ramos case, the Ramos hearing that had taken place in 1999. And as you know, the Ramos hearing was an HCRC hearing that dealt with this exact same issue, whether or not Chapter 515 requires housing providers to engage in good faith when a disabled tenant makes a requested accommodation.
Well, why wouldn't A4 control then? It does say you have to negotiate.
Well, we had brought the claim under 515.39, and again, we follow the findings that were made in the Ramos case. Yes, it was back in 1999, but the director still believes that those findings hold true today. And in the Ramos hearing, the HCRC commissioners, they did look at Title VII cases and ADA cases, I believe, and that's how they had extracted that requirement for good faith interaction was from a Title VII case. I believe that was the Taylor v. Phoenixville Schools case that is cited in that Ramos hearing.
Part of the reason, counsel, though, for administrative rules is notice. It's notice to parties as to what is expected of them and what the commission will seek to enforce. So, I mean, without language in the statute or the rules talking about the requirement for an interactive process, I mean, isn't that just an unfair process to then require, you know, to find that they have acted inappropriately where it's not spelled out in the rules anywhere?
Well, let me say this. If you look at 515.39 as it is right now, then also if you look at it right up against the Fair Housing Act's disability reasonable accommodation statute, as you're looking at those two statutes next to each other, you'll notice that that first part in 515.39 and the entirety of the Fair Housing Act, they mirror one another, right? But
are you talking about how it reads now, post 2022?
Yes.
After the language was added, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And those, that language primarily, if not entirely, dealt with service animals. That was the intent of the that was the purpose of the legislature as set out in that bill,
yes.
Adopted in 2022, which was after the events here, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So we can't really rely on that language for purposes of this case,
mm-hmm.
or is your argument different?
Well, with regards to this good faith requirement for the interactive process, I'm arguing that that is what the statute meant during this case, and that is what the statute still means today, and that extra part that was added recently, it just bolsters our argument that good faith interaction is required by the statute. Because as I was saying...
Okay, but where is that spelled out in the plain language of 389? I mean, there's no mention of it whatsoever.
Well, Your Honor, as you're reading that statute, as I was saying, that first part of 515.39 and the Fair Housing Act Disability Reasonable Accommodation Statute, they mirror each other, but where the Fair Housing Act ends, 515.39 goes on, and it does provide an interactive process between the housing provider and the disabled tenant. It gives housing providers the right to request for verifying.
Well, the revision doesn't even apply to this case.
Well, that's our argument too, Your Honors. Our defendants argue that after that first part in 515.39, they argue that that part only applies when a disabled tenant makes a requested accommodation for an assistance animals.
Well, but Your Honor, that was added in 2022.
Yes.
This is a 2020 case.
Yes.
And 515.3A9 was really short.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's as I read to you,
yeah.
Right? And... yeah, it doesn't talk about an interactive process, right?
Yeah.
But A4 does talk about a duty to negotiate.
Yes, yeah.
But so I'm kind of wondering why you didn't bring it under A4.
Mm. Well, but I guess I'm arguing that not just back then, but even now, as I said, even more, 515.39 requires a good faith interaction between the parties. Again, 515.39 gives housing providers the right to request for verifying medical information, and it requires disabled tenants to provide that verifying medical information if they're asked for it. Defendants then brought up the fact that the word may is used in the statute, right? And the word may is used. But again, this is the interactive process. This is back and forth. This is case by case, Your Honors. In a lot of these situations, when a disabled tenant makes a requested accommodation, the housing provider is just going to grant it without ever asking for any type of verifying medical information. But if the housing provider wants such information, 515.39 gives them the right to request such information. And again, it requires disabled tenants to provide such information if they're asked for it.
Now that A4 has been raised by the court, do you have a position as to whether or not that implies an interactive process or not?
I have not looked into it, Your Honors. I'm sorry.
Let me shift to 515.2 and the definition of disability. And we haven't really talked much about that. And I think your opposing side brought it up briefly, and then we moved on to other issues. But, you know, and you started off with talking about the lethal nature of the pandemic. Many of our questions have taken us back to those times. You know, a person with maybe a heart condition, a respiratory condition, or any condition, even an elderly person, could possibly be turned into a disabled person during an ongoing public health crisis. And does that just mean that during a public health crisis, anybody really could be considered disabled? I mean, what's the limiting principle here?
Well, not just anybody, right? And the way that Robert found out that his heart disease made him high risk was...
Okay, I'm not talking specifically. I'm talking generally. What about an elderly person who might not really even have any true underlying conditions other than being old? Are they disabled under your... position? Again, what would be the limiting principle here and during an ongoing public health crisis?
Well, they would have to fall under the definition of disability, right? Which is having a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits a major life activity.
So age is not necessarily an impairment, right?
No, Your Honor.
Well, let's say age and some sort of health condition, such as maybe a respiratory. Let's say this. Maybe it's severe flu season, a person has a respiratory issue. Could that person refuse to allow cleaners into their place for 6 months?
That seems very similar to the Fon situation, so I believe that now my office would take a really hard look at
Haven't there been some asthma cases that, you know, like respiratory illnesses are considered disabilities?
Yes, yes. Such as when there's smoking in an apartment building and the disabled tenant will ask if they can move the smoking area someplace else because of their COPD or another respiratory disease. And
let's say somebody had a peanut allergy. Could they say, or would the person who owned the property say, we can't allow third persons to have peanuts in the common areas?
I think that may be unreasonable, but you would have to do the whole analysis. And when you're talking about whether or not the accommodation is reasonable, it's very fact intensive. You got to know all the facts, all the situations. And so that's our main argument with regards to this reasonableness element, is that it should go to a jury to decide and not at this point in the case.
Now, in terms of interactive process, I understand you're asking that this court basically adopt hearing officer Olivia Wang's decision in the Ramos case, right?
Yes,
as to what liability would arise. First of all, following up on just what Justice Ginoza was asking, how does a member of the public get to see the Ramos decision?
It's right on top of our website.
It's on your website?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then second, the standard that's laid out there is respondent knew about the complainant's disability, complainant requested accommodations or assistance for the disability, respondent did not make a good faith effort to assist the complainant in seeking accommodations, and for complainant could have been reasonably accommodated, but for the respondent's lack of good faith. So in other words, this good faith standard here in this failure to engage in an interactive process basically would completely preclude summary judgment, wouldn't it? Because how do we get into the good faith intent, the mind of the landlord?
Yep, it'll be very fact intensive, Your Honors. Yeah.
I mean,
I'd agree with that.
It would be really hard to establish. Isn't the real issue whether or not a reasonable accommodation was being made? And the point made in the Ramos decision is, in order to determine whether an accommodation is reasonable, you do have to engage in the interactive process because you have to try to figure out what is reasonable under the circumstances, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But the bottom line is whether or not a reasonable accommodation was offered.
Yeah.
And in order to ascertain what's reasonable, you do need to negotiate because you don't know. You don't know what the person's situation is. You don't know what the person might need. You don't know what the person is asking for,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And as the Ramos findings had laid out, it had laid out those public policy reasons of why good faith interaction should be required.
Or would you say what I asked Mr. Valencia is, isn't that just part of the unreasonable analysis?
The failure to engage and the failure to actually not even offer a reasonable accommodation, I think it would be a part of the unreasonable analysis.
But not necessarily requiring it is an automatic thing to do. That's sort of where you differ from,
well,
from their position.
Our argument is not a per se argument, right? Again, and that's the difference between what the plaintiff disabled tenant in the Ninth Circuit Howard case was arguing for, right? In that case, the disabled tenant was arguing that the Fair Housing Act created standalone liability for housing providers' failure to engage in an interactive process, even if the requested accommodation was not reasonable or not necessary. But that's not what the director is arguing for today. It's never been personal. It's never been per se liability. It's always been if, but for that failure to engage in good faith, the disabled tenant could have been reasonably accommodated. And so that's the difference between what the director is arguing for today and the Ninth Circuit Howard case, right? In that case, as you said, Your Honor, in that case, the Ninth Circuit said, no, there's no per se liability for such a failure, and that liability would only lie when there was an available and reasonable accommodation, and a defendant either failed to or refused to provide that accommodation. I think at that point, the Ninth Circuit was talking about cases in the employment context, I believe, at that point when just mentioning that. That liability only lies when there is an available and reasonable accommodation and the defendant employer failed to provide such an accommodation. So again, it's not per se liability. That wasn't the Ramos finding And the Ramos finding went right along with the decision in Ramos, right? They found for the housing provider, despite also finding that the housing provider failed to engage in good faith. Because they also found at the same time that the requested accommodation was not reasonable, right? It would have caused an undue burden. And again, that's exactly what the director is arguing for here today. And not just what 515.39 was during this case, but what it is right now. Because again, if you look at the statute, it gives housing providers the right to request that verified medical information, and it requires disabled tenants to provide that verified medical information if they're asked for it.
Do you know whether or not the Fair Housing Act includes language like 515.3A4, refusal to negotiate?
Not within its disability reasonable accommodation statute.
It's not in the Fair Housing Act statute? We'll look it up, but you don't know off the top of your head whether...
No, I'm sorry.
We'll look it up. Thank you.
You have a few more minutes. You want to type the argument?
I guess I just want to welcome if there's any more questions about the reasonableness element or the necessity element. Defendants, Mr. Valencia was saying that there's no argument to all the facts, but there is, because we would never have moved forward on this case if we didn't agree with their claims that the property was left damaged, trashed, and filthy. Then even further, the funds were willing to engage with the defendants at all times, but for whatever reasons, defendants refused to engage, at least not in good faith, because many of their questions that they had at the time could have been answered if they just asked.
Counsel, so let me make sure I understand your position under Ramos and the argument you're making here. Regardless of whether there was a good faith effort to engage, your client would still need to prove that a reasonable accommodation could have been reached.
Right? Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Okay. So it. I mean, that's still ultimately one of the requirements, regardless of whether we create a standalone liability or not.
Regardless of the standalone liability.
I mean, well, it's not a standalone. What it is was there a reasonable accommodation that could have been provided or not?
And that's the ultimate question under both
right.
theories of liability under
5.3. Yeah, I quite don't understand then this idea of a standalone liability. It's not standalone.
Yeah.
It's related to whether your client, could prove that a reasonable accommodation should have been provided.
Yeah, that's the main issue. And I guess I'll say with regards to that is that I have not seen a case that we found that there was cause on that wasn't cause on both of those theories of liabilities under 515.39. Because as Justice Ginoza just said, that the main issue is whether or not a reasonable accommodation was available and whether or not it was provided.
Well, truly, it might have been that a number of us have maybe trying to address that in different ways, but thank you for clarifying.
Yeah.
Thank you, Counsel.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, we had many questions for you, so we'll give you some additional time on rebuttal. Thanks.
Just to follow up on some questions and arguments that were made, there were questions and comments about the Ramos decision, and I just want to read a portion of that decision. It's on page 6 of the Ramos decision. Although the policies underlying the interactive process are undermined by a party's failure to participate in the interactive process, the Commission agrees with the recommended decision that there is no per se liability in this particular housing case. So they're saying there's no per se liability for failure to engage. There's a footnote, and the footnote coincides with the CJ's comment unlike our housing rules, the commission's employment discrimination rules provide to determine the appropriate reasonable accommodation and shall be necessary for an employer or other covered entity to initiate an interactive process after a request for accommodation with the qualified person with a disability in need of the accommodation. That's the Hawaii Administrative Rule 12-46-187B. So that is where the failure to engage in the interactive process in the employment context in Hawaii comes from. It's in the rule. You don't have that here. So, I've been practicing 30 years. I didn't know about this decision. So how's a general member of the public supposed to find this? They go to their website and just start randomly looking for things like this. It's just not how things should be done. You have, for example, too, in the on the federal level. So where the interactive process comes from there is 29 CFR 1630.2. That's an EEOC rule. So how did they get that rule? Well, they drafted a rule, had public hearing, they took testimony, they enacted it. The commission does that all the time. I participated in that process myself. So if they want this done, there's two ways to do it correctly. I think the best way is to go to the legislature. And every year, the commission, when they meet, they produce a list of bills that they take a position on, either take a position, no position, oppose, or whatever. They draft their own legislation. That's the way to do this. That's the best way to do this. The other way is to draft their own rules, have a public hearing, let the public participate, publish the rule. That's the way this should be done. Regarding the reasonableness.
Would you concede that 515.3A4 refusal to negotiate for a real estate transaction does apply to post-lease negotiations? That does impose a duty to negotiate.
I don't think that's clear, Justice McKenna, in looking at the definition of real estate transaction. Sale, exchange, rental, or lease of property. The way I interpret that...
It says includes, right?
Includes, which
and
means
including... And then the commission has further definitions of real estate transaction.
Yes. But if you're asking me whether I concede that that provision imposes a standalone duty to engage in the interactive process that creates standalone liability, no, I don't see that. That language just simply isn't there.
Well, are you saying, let's say pre-lease, refusal to negotiate?
Yes.
There would be liability.
That's not an interactive process. That's just plain language that you're enforcing. So, yes, I agree with that. And I think that looking at the definition, that's what it applies to. Sale, exchange, rental, or lease, not post-lease.
Yes, but one says to refuse to engage in a real estate transaction.
Right.
And four says refuse to negotiate for a real estate transaction. They're obviously intended to mean different things, I think.
Arguably, I mean, they mean the same thing to me, that someone comes to you and they want to buy a piece of property or they want to rent a piece of property. I think that's what it's referring to. They want to sell. They want to buy. You can't refuse to negotiate with them. That's one. And you cannot refuse to sell or rent to them. That's two.
Are you arguing that the rules of the commission exceed the statutory mandate when they define real estate transaction to include... It includes but not limited to actions to real property after the lease?
No.
Or cancellation or termination of a lease?
No.
Because we are talking about here we did have issues regarding cancellation or termination of the lease, right?
We did. I think that's a completely different claim. And that's not the claim they brought. That's not the claim they've argued.
And well, they're saying that they were kicked out illegally based on disability, right?
Correct.
Discrimination.
Correct. Right. Yeah, I don't think it's kind of bringing it back to where we go from here on the interactive process issue. I mean, if you're asking me whether or not all of the language we're talking about creates a standalone liability in this context, I would say no. I don't think so. And regarding the reasonableness issue, I want to correct something that counsel said. He said that They were willing to engage at all times with us. And that's not what the record shows. I mean, we talked about the letter that we got from their lawyer. That letter said, don't enforce, give us damages, reduce our rent. That's not a will, and you have 3 days to pay up. That's not a willingness to engage. And in response to the CJ's reference a few times about this September email, what came shortly after that was our motion, the complaint, our motion, not shortly after that, but we have, I correct that, let me bring that back, not shortly after that, October 6, 2023, there is a declaration submitted by Robert Fahn, Brenda Fahn. They're identical. Paragraph 10. On September 30th, 2020, Brenda sent an email to Defendant Simone McCaffrey and Dio Hauhau requesting a disability-based reasonable accommodation from me in the form of foregoing the weekly cleanings provision. So that's not come in once a week. That's don't do it at all. That's the position that they took at least from around.
This is an MSJ. We look at the entire record. We look at everything that may be admissible in evidence. The email itself is attached, and it does refer to what the Chief Justice said.
It does. I'm just...
If I can ask you, yeah. Counsel.
Yes,
sir. You know, because part of the argument you made is that it's a fundamental alteration of your client's policy.
Yeah.
If the proposal was, let's allow the weekly cleanings, but let's try just for an hour and find the time to do it, would that be a fundamental alteration of your client's policy or a slight alteration?
I think it's fundamental, especially when you look at what they were bringing with them. So it's a husband, wife, three kids, and three dogs. And one of the things the Fifth Circuit did was he went and looked up the breed of dog. It's a long-haired dog. And I don't know if any of you have dogs. I have a border collie, and I tell people, you come to my house, you're leaving with complimentary dog hair from my house. I mean, they shed. So they're and if you put that in context of the amendments that you were asking about to 515.39, those were related to service animals. And it allows the landlord to ask for additional information regarding pets because pets come with their own set of additional problems. So if you're going to artificially limit the cleaning to 1 hour when you have those set of facts, it's not reasonable. That is a fundamental alteration. And that's where I was going to close up my comments there.
That's assuming everything else you threw in there, though, about dogs and everything else. I know there were dogs, but the shedding and how much time it would take to clean, I mean, that's speculating at this point, isn't it? In other words, it's a trial of an hour weekly. That offer was never taken off.
Well, I guess...
By your clients.
I'm struggling a bit because you're asking if it's speculation. I would say, based on my personal experience, no, it's not speculation because I know exactly what long-term...
Sorry, Justin, isn't based on your personal experience.
I agree. That's why I was struggling with how to answer this because... But the Fifth Circuit did actually look up the breed of dog. That's in the record. That's in the transcript. So long-haired dogs shed. So this isn't just a situation where you have, let's say, an elderly couple with no pets coming in, and that's a different
situation. Are you saying the trial court went outside of the record on its own? When you say looked it up? Well, what are you talking about?
He, in the transcript, he says that he went and looked up the breed of dog.
Is that admissible evidence? Should that be considered on a summary judgment?
I would say it can be if you're looking at judicial notice. So
is judicial notice taken?
That's what it sounds like to me. So judicial notice can come
in. Official formal judicial notice taken of what that extraneous information may have been considered.
Well, judicial notice, I that's what I'm trying to answer. So judicial notice comes in the form of the lawyer requesting it or the judge doing it on its own. So did the judge say, I'm taking judicial notice? No, that's not in the transcript. But in effect, is that what he did? I would say yes, that's what he did. So I don't think that's...
What source the court may have reviewed?
Probably what all of us would do is go to Google. Google knows everything. So we go and look up the breed of dog on the internet.
You're going to take judicial notice of a Google posting?
Well, and I'm not trying to be cavalier here, but yeah, I think that's probably what he did. I don't know. I don't know exactly how he determined what kind of long-haired dog this was, other than he said he looked it up. So I don't know how he would have looked it up other than going on the internet.
Counsel, why don't you wrap up your argument?
Yes, CJ. So I just want to go back to really the legal elements. So the legal elements are, for on the reasonableness side, one, was there a disability? Two, did we know about it? Three, was the accommodation necessary to afford them an equal opportunity to use and enjoy the dwelling? Four, was the accommodation reasonable? And five, did we refuse to make the requested accommodation? And under the, and we're challenging three and four. That's the issues. I think those are the third and fourth elements. So the accommodation is necessary if they're not able to use and enjoy the premises if we don't provide what they're asking for. What they were asking for was, don't do it. We offered to clean when they were not there. That was reasonable, I think. So I don't think they can overcome that based on the undisputed facts in the record.
Well, if I may, they moved from the mainland because of COVID to Hawaii because they thought it was safer and we had protocols. So don't you think it was... And I'm sure your client knew that. I'm sure that was expressed. So don't you think that knowing that and then for their request to not have cleaning people come into their apartment and go through everything in their apartment, basically, touch every surface, all of that, don't you think that your clients could have considered giving it a go, maybe at 1 hour a week? Instead of just shutting it down completely, because they did know how important it was that the family felt that staying away from COVID, right? So how is that a reasonable accommodation if you won't even try some of their suggestions?
Because we're not required to offer every possible reasonable accommodation. We're required to provide a reasonable accommodation. And so our position is what we offered was reasonable. Were there other things that could have been tried? Yes, there could have been other things that could have been tried, but that's not what the law requires. We don't have to require.
So as long as the landlord offers something that the landlord deems reasonable and may be considered reasonable, that's it.
That's what the law requires. And on that fourth,
there's no duty to negotiate under those circumstances.
There's no duty to engage in the interactive process as standalone liability. That's
there is a duty to negotiate under A4.
Yes, we kind of discussed that. I think that applies to entering into transactions, not these particular set of facts here. And I don't really need to talk about the last one because, CJ, you asked me the question about the fundamental alteration. So I just stand on my comments regarding whether this was a fundamental alteration. But when you're deciding whether or not to send this back, that's the analysis that I think you should go through using the undisputed facts in the record.
We understand. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the arguments. Court will take this under advisement.
Beku Iluna. Please rise. Well, o ku'u ia mai ne kea aha o kolokolo ki eke hanohano o ka moko aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.